You are listening to Security Wire Weekly for July 30th, 2008. One-upping the Fishers. Welcome to the program. I'm Rob Westerveld. In this edition, we'll talk with Billy Rios and Nitesh Donjani about their research infiltrating the phishing underground. They're presenting their research August 6th at the Black Hat Briefing in Las Vegas. In a moment, Billy Rios and Nitesh Donjani, but first, this message.
There's analysts. There's industry experts, and there's the Security Squad. In a monthly podcast series, the writers and editors of SearchSecurity.com and Information Security Magazine debate today's hot-button security issues. Everything from the demise of network access control to terrorism to the merits of compliance. No topic is out of bounds. Join the discussion. Download Security Squad and our other great podcast today. Go to searchsecurity.com/podcast. That's searchsecurity.com/podcast.
Well, joining me today are well-known security researchers Billy Rios and Nitesh Donjani. They've done a lot of research into the phishing underground. They've actually infiltrated them and put together quite a package here of information about how the phishing underground works, where the phishers get their tools from, and how they actually package and sell the credit card information and other data that they collect. The topic of their briefing is called Bad Sushi, Beating the Phishers at Their Own Game. Billy, Nitesh, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Now, you guys have been studying the phishing underground for quite some time. How did you begin your research? You know, where did you guys team up? Why did you guys team up? And where did you guys start to look? Nitesh, maybe you could start.
Sure. Billy and I were chatting online, like we sometimes usually do at the end of the day, talking about, you know, the kinds of things we've been involved with. And, I had a PayPal account, and I was kind of going through my spam folder, and I realized that a lot of the spam that I got was filled with these, you know, phishing emails that came my way. And that kind of started off our conversation between Billy and I. As we go through the questions, it'll become probably more clear. But as we started chatting about what phishing means and, you know, what research has been done with phishing, we quickly realized that a lot of research has already been done around the statistics of phishing, such as, you know, what countries are these phishers based out of, what countries host the most phishing sites and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we asked ourselves, well, that's good and all, but we couldn't find much research on how do these phishers actually think, what's going on in their head, how do they communicate, what happens to all the data they collect from the victim. So as we started chatting about, you know, this kind of knowledge, we quickly realized that there wasn't any such knowledge captured before. And so one thing led to the other, and our curiosity got us to where we are. And we, you know, kind of put all the research we've done together and presented it at Black Hat.
Sure. Now, Billy, in terms of the phishing underground and its evolution, why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, where phishing began? Why hasn't there been that much research on it? Has it been primarily under the radar thus far? And has it become easier to conduct research on it now that it's a little more sophisticated, you know, with the tools involved?
Right, I think that's a great question. I'll start with why this type of research maybe hasn't been done before. There's a lot of smart people definitely out there. They're doing a lot of research on phishing and are looking at a lot of aspects, as far as phishing goes. I think Nitesh and I, our background is a little bit different. We have a lot of computer security background. We have a lot of penetration testing background. We like to look at things from a security standpoint, security engineering. design reviews, that sort of stuff. And so the way we look at things is a little bit different. And so when we came across this problem, our thought process and the things that we're looking for and the things that interest us, it's a lot different than I think, you know, it's a lot different than those things that interest other people who are doing traditional phishing research that kind of look into this stuff. So when we see something, when we see an opportunity, we're going to go about taking advantage of that opportunity a little bit differently. So instead of trying to find out, let's say, you know, where these people are coming from, what's the amount of emails they're sending out, phishing emails they're sending out every day, how can I measure this from a statistical standpoint, how can I track URLs, that sort of stuff. Instead of looking at that sort of stuff, which is important, I don't want people to think that's not important. Instead of looking at that kind of stuff, me and Nitesh looked at it in a different way. We told ourselves, like, let's get these tools. Let's talk to these people. Let's convince these fishers that we're fishers too and see how they communicate with each other, see how they talk to each other. What are the things they're talking about? You know, how do they communicate with each other? How do they get the tools that they need? Where do they sell the identities once they're stolen? Basically, you know, we just basically befriended a bunch of fishers and people in this industry and just kind of took a look at how things would run if we were on the inside looking out instead of on the outside looking in. So it's a great perspective that I don't think has been presented anywhere before, and I think that's, you know, probably one of the best things about the talk. And so as far as the tools go and the sophistication that you mentioned, what we realized is that a lot of the people that we were talking to, they're not really sophisticated. And so, and we talk about this during the talk, that's a double-edged sword, we think. It's a double-edged sword in the fact that these people aren't very sophisticated, so it's not like we're tracking ninja hackers, people who have a very hardcore, low-level understanding of technology and the way to, you know, the things that they need to do to protect themselves, to keep themselves anonymous, to keep people from tracking them. They don't have that understanding. But, you know, the double-edged sword is that they don't need that. And so, you know, if they don't need to be the ninja hacker, if they don't need to have that sophistication, that means a lot of people can do it. And that means it's open, you know, the barrier to entry into this market, if someone wants to do this, it's very, very low. It doesn't require a lot of sophistication. All it really requires is a little bit of time and just basically reaching out to the right people, asking the right questions in the right way, getting the right tools, and then deploying that. And that's probably one of the most disturbing things I think we saw in our research.
And that's probably why we're seeing an increase of phishing over time, right? Because it's becoming a little bit easier with these automated tools?
It is very easy. I know, the phishing industry seems to be almost moving to, like, you know, a service-oriented industry where, it used to be one person had to code the phishing kit, code the website, code the back end that's going to steal the information, code the tools to verify whether or not the credit card information they were stealing was good or legitimate or not, code the piece of, the piece of software that's going to check the credit card limits or check the bank accounts, and, you know, code the piece of software that's going to send out all the spam. Well, that's not the case anymore. Everything's very modularized now. And so if someone wants to send out a lot of spam emails, verify credit cards, get phishing kits and that sort of stuff, that stuff's already done. All they need to know is either they need to know who to ask to get that stuff, or they need to have some money to be able to buy these tools so that they can utilize them for their purposes. So exactly, the barrier to entry to get into this market is a lot lower than it used to be.
Sure. Nitesh, maybe you can answer this. I should back up for a second. Maybe we're not seeing a lot more phishing. We're just seeing a lot more successful phishes?
It's hard to get a handle on the exact amount from a statistical perspective, but I would, you know, if I had to rationally, kind of logically think about it, yeah, you would be right in saying people are more successful now than they ever have been, because the amount of phishing attacks that are being launched is exponentially growing. I mean, according to Gartner, I think the phishing industry cost businesses about $3.6 billion, and about 3.2 million people lost their identities to phishing attacks last year, and that number is significantly going to go up this year. Now, if you look at from a numbers perspective, if you really look at what is it that a fisher has to do to launch an attack, I mean, the technical sophistication, as we talked about earlier, is low. Because what do you need to do? If you're a fisher and you want to launch an attack, it's very simple. All you need to do is download some of the script kiddie tools, go after all the source you can find on the internet, which are not configured properly or not patched properly, and compromise any one of those hosts, which is actually pretty easy to do if your scope is unlimited. And once you have access to one of these servers, install a website that looks like some other website. So if you really look at what you need to do from a technical perspective, you have nothing to lose if you're a phisher, especially if you're located outside the United States. And if you speak to the FBI, if you're a corporation in the U.S. and you realize that, you know, there's a web server out there, especially if there's a web server located outside the U.S., that is hosting a website that targets your company and your customers, the FBI, from a legal perspective, the federal agencies here in the U.S., are limited in what they can do to help you. If the host and the phisher himself or herself is located outside the U.S. So from a technical perspective and a legal perspective, you have nothing to lose. So just, you know, knowing that, it's pretty rational to think that the amount of attacks are only going to go up.
Billy, you talked about befriending phishers as part of your research. Has anybody ever asked you, about the have you thought about the ethics involved in that? And
yeah, I say befriended, and it kind of sounds like, you know, we did a lot of tricks to kind of fool people into doing this and that. But the reality of it is that, you know, that's not the case. There's no, and we show this in the talk where we show various sites and various forums where people are communicating with each other. There's no secret handshake that you need to know to get in with these groups. There's no special passwords, or there's no, there's not some special thing that you have to do to prove yourself to these people at all. You can strike up a conversation with any one of these people at any time and just say, hey, you know what, this is what I'm looking for. What do I need to do to get this? Can you give me some of these tools? Can you give me some of these phishing kits? Can you show me where to go to get more information about this and this and this? And eventually you find, more and more places where these people are congregating, communicating with each other, talking about the latest scams that they're doing, talking about the latest tools that they're doing, talking about other phishers and other scammers that they can't trust, talking about other methods that they're going to be using besides phishing, that they're going to be able to steal people's identities and credit card information and such. And so it really was, almost too easy. When me and Nitesh looked at this, we said, it can't be this easy. The barrier to entry to this industry cannot be this low, where basically anybody, if they just happen to stumble across the right place, will be able to get into this industry and basically after a day be able to launch their own phishing enterprise, so to say. It can't be that low. And that's something that we kind of hit really hard in the presentation, as to, when you watch the presentation, you'll see that it's not just one or two people that we're looking at. It's many different phishers. It's many different people pulling off these scams. It's many different forums that have this information, not just one or two. And it's something that we kind of push forward and push and drive home during the presentation.
How rich are these guys getting?
That's tough to tell. I think that's tough to tell. I think there's a couple examples that we show in the presentation where we show some of the scale that some of these people are operating at. A lot of people have this misconception for some reason that, when someone steals an identity or two, they're selling it one off here and there. But we saw places where basically credit card information, banking information, it was being moved in bulk. I mean, you could only buy 500 credit cards at a time. That's the minimum. And that gives you some idea of the scale of some of these operations that some of these people are basically using in their business, so to say. So I think it's a little tough to tell. There's so many people involved. I wouldn't be able to throw out some kind of number out there saying this is how rich these people are. But there are a few examples of some people or some scammers or places where there is a lot of transactions going on. And these people are probably making a lot of money. And they're basically operating with impunity. They're just out in the open for anyone to come and basically purchase what they have to sell.
Does the organization actually get that intricate? I mean, do some of these guys actually join together so that they can get 500 credit cards together and then sort of split the profits?
I think it's more, I don't know, from what we've seen, I did come across one place that seemed like it was pretty organized, and it took a little bit of effort to do a little more reconnaissance on what they were doing and such. I think for the most part, the other places seem like they were just small groups of people doing this, because once again, all the tools that they need are readily available. It's not like they need a large organization to pull off these types of attacks against people on a large scale. A small group of people can do it. They can do it against, like Nitesh said, an unlimited scope. They can do it against as many people as they want. The tools are available. They don't have to have a development shop, or they don't have to, specifically have someone that knows knowledge of certain pieces of OSs or software to develop the exploitation for that. All that stuff's available for them basically as a service. They can purchase that, or they can trade for that and get that capability into their small group. So I don't know if Natasha, if you agree with that or...
I fully agree.
Yeah, Nitesh, where do the botnets actually come in here? And is it the automated tools that are actually, I don't want to say leveraging, but, using the botnets in order to make attacks more successful, or are the botnets less used at this point?
Quite frankly, I think maybe Billy can add to that. But I think from our perspective for this research that we presented, the layer of the actual infrastructure, which is the botnet, that are used by some sophisticated phishing groups, is something that was out of scope for what we looked at. We were really going after how do these guys communicate, what do their phishing sites look like. Mm-hmm. But we did come across some instances where the botnets were almost used to facilitate almost as a service for a particular group to kind of launch phishing sites on a massive scale. But I have to admit that from the purposes of our research, that was a layer that was out of scope for what we looked at.
Sure. Let's talk about where these phishers are based. Are they based in many different areas of the world? And how do they communicate with each other if they're working together? How does somebody in Russia, for example, communicate with somebody in China?
Right. So that's a great question. So from a statistical perspective, I think it's easy to say, and you can find research on this, on where the actual hosts or the IP addresses are that host the phishing sites. And people are surprised that the United States is the largest, is the country where the largest IP addresses that host phishing sites are. What that basically tells us is, from a rational perspective, that U.S. is a technology-oriented country and has probably the biggest internet presence. So that makes sense. But that doesn't mean that's where the fishers are located. And this takes me back, the question you asked takes me back to how we actually stumble upon some of the information and how they trade contact information, how the fishers communicate. We happen to be starting a simple server-side script from a phishing kit. Once we opened up the actual phishing kit, it was a phishing kit that was made for a popular bank. And once we kind of looked at the source code for the phishing kit, now the phishing kit is basically comprised of two different things. The client-side script, which renders the website to look like the bank that's being phished, and the server-side script, which is, in most cases, a PHP script that takes the information submitted by the victim from the client side and emails it to the phisher. So we're looking at the server-side PHP script, and there was a string embedded in the server-side script. And so we decided to find more servers that hosted the same server-side script. And so we went to Google and put in the server-side string that we found in that script. And what Billy and I thought we would get back from Google, this is from early on in our research, we thought we would get back locations of other compromised servers that are hosting the same phishing site or that server-side script. But what we got back completely floored us. I think we're still kind of traumatized by what we saw. What we saw that Google came back to us with was not locations where the server-side script existed, but actual information, the actual data that the phisher, that the victim had submitted to the phisher, being shared on message boards across the world. So we, I think by just going for that one string, stumbled upon about 8 to 10 message boards that are publicly available, no authentication required, where people are posting, among 3 to 4 hours fresh, identities of victims that have submitted to phishing sites, and you'll find things like social security numbers, date of birth, ATM card numbers, ATM pins, bank usernames, bank passwords, mother's maiden name, you name it. And one of the things we realize is if you find one message board where phishers are communicating this data, it gives you a good entry point to find the other locations where other phishers are meeting up. So it's kind of mind-boggling, but you can start with one phishing site, uncover the server-side script, and almost uncover the entire ecosystem behind the phishing underground. And as we start looking at this, we realize that at first, you know, we kind of looked at all the identities being exposed for free, and we thought, well, why are phishers sharing these identities for free with each other? And I think that's when Billy made a good point, is that phishers like to kind of deal like drug dealers do. They kind of like to give you one or two identities for free, and just to prove that they are legit, that they are selling you real identities, and then turn around and sell identities to you in bulk. And the message board system, if you kind of study it a little bit, you realize that phishers kind of sell identities to each other on a reputation-based system. So if you have a phisher and then on a message board that has, you know, charged somebody money, has not delivered identities, you'll see other people gossiping about him or her to make sure that that other buyers don't, you know, fall for that guy.
And these guys are leaving these message boards wide open. Anybody can go in there. There's no authentication whatsoever. Why would they do that?
Because it's just easy to communicate. I mean, it's easy to communicate. You'll also find other message boards, which is really surprising. Is, I mean, if you are a phisher and you buy server space or to host a phishing to host a message board for all the other phishers to communicate, you'll get shut down really, you know, fast and easy as soon as somebody figures out you're doing this. So realize that what phishers like to do is they kind of congregate at message boards, a lot of message boards that are not being used anymore. So there was an instance where, you know, one of our Google searches led us to a message board for audio enthusiasts, right? And we realized that message board has been abandoned. It's a free message board hosted by some provider. And whoever set it up, you know, nobody was posting any more threads on it. It was kind of abandoned, but still, you could still go and post, you know, unmoderated comments on there. And so you find that phishers congregated over there. So they have nothing to lose. I mean, you know, you show an identity or two for free, and somebody looks at it and tries to open up a bank account or credit card line with that person's identity. And, you know, if he or she is successful, that tells that buyer that you as a phisher who posted that are legit, and he or she will come back to you and buy more identities from you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Billy, what currency are these guys using in order to buy and sell, and how do they turn it into cash?
And we saw a lot of bartering going on. I know a lot of like identity trading. What we saw was a lot of transactions going through eGold. I think eGold just recently faced some litigation here and went through. But at the time we did the research, we saw a lot of that going through there. And there's a couple other places that are mentioned, and we have those places in the talk. But I think what's important here is that when we started pushing into this phishing problem here and taking a look at what's going on, how these people interact and talk to each other, what we realized is that, you know, the phishing problem isn't just a web page that's being displayed to a user someplace on their home computer. A phishing problem, and this whole problem, is actually, it's just a symptom of this, you know, this entire ecosystem that exists to steal identities, steal stuff from people, to steal the bank account, credit card information. And so the web pages that people see, the phishing sites, that's just one little piece of this entire ecosystem, like Mitesh mentioned before. There's other pieces that are involved. There's pieces that help these people communicate. There's pieces that help these people transfer money or value between each other. There's other scams that are going on. There's places where these people can buy tools. There's places where people can get new kits. There's places where these people can communicate with each other to find out who they should be doing business on this reputation scale, basically, and who they should not be doing business with. And all these little pieces kind of feed into this ecosystem. And so when you take a look at just, you know, you think of phishing, you think of just, you know, the first thing that pops into your head is this website that looks kind of like a financial institution's website or that looks like a popular website and it's asking you for your information. That's just one little small piece of this entire ecosystem. And so, you know, it's I'm glad that you asked that. So, you know, how are they transferring money? How are they getting, you know, money from this? How are they getting value from this? Well, that's just another piece of this ecosystem, this giant ecosystem that's supporting this, you know, all these activities, all these illicit activities going on. And there's a lot of little small pieces to this entire ecosystem that people just don't think about, you know, like, you know, where do they get their tools from? How, if they need to purchase a tool, how do they purchase a tool? How do they transfer money from one person to the other person without giving up where they're from or giving up their identity or and that sort of stuff? You know, how does one go about letting other fishers know that they're a reputable person to be doing business with? All these little nuances, all these little pieces go into this ecosystem and make up the entire ecosystem. So, you know, after a while, with after, you know, looking at these guys and tracking them and identifying where they're communicating and stuff, we start to come across other scams, you know, not just phishing, but like ATM scams and these other scams. And sometimes there's fishers scamming fishers, you know, and we call that fisher-on-fisher crime. And so it's basically a little microcosm, its own little world kind of operating off on itself. And it's an interesting look to get just a sneak peek of how that world operates and how it works.
Let's talk about what can be done then. Right now, vendors like VeriSign are hyping the EVSSL certificates as a way to stop phishing. Other people are saying financial institutions need to get together and stop sending out links and email messages. What's the answer then? How do you beat fishers at their own game? Is it going to take law enforcement to go in and use your methods to seek them out? Is it always going to be a cat and mouse game?
You know, let me take that up. You know, the EV certificates from VeriSign is something that is commendable. I mean, one of the solutions is to provide a browser UI standard that I can go to my grandmother and say, you know, when you see this green bar, you're okay. But I think some people take education and awareness too far. I mean, I can't expect my grandmother to be able to parse URLs, but I can expect her. I think it's reasonable for me to tell her, okay, look for the green bar, you know, that the EV certificates provide to people. But I think that is something that is commendable. But there's some things to watch out for, though. I mean, if your website has a cross-site scripting vulnerability, for example, an EV certificate is not going to help you. It's actually going to make problems worse for you. But given that, still, EV certificates are commendable. I think it's a good thing that there are browser standards now that, you know, a green address bar is something I can go back to my clients and people in my family and say, just watch out for the green bar and, you know, you're okay. But, I mean, what else, is that going to solve the problem? No. I think the root cause of why phishing is successful is our reliance on static identifiers. So let me give you an example. When we are, you know, in the U.S., when a U.S. citizen is born, he or she is given a Social Security number, right? That is the root cause. You have a Social Security number that is static. It never changes, right? And as you grow up, your parents ask you to memorize your Social Security number and request that you don't share it with people you do not trust. But as you grow older, what do? Every time you get a job, you have to give out a Social Security number. Every time you call up somebody you don't even know for a credit card account, you have to give out your Social Security number. And that number gets persisted across databases, in databases across the world. And what does somebody need to take over your identity is that very Social Security number that never changes. It's static. That is the root cause of the problem. We can temporarily put Band-Aids around that root cause that we are doing with EV certificates and things like that. But I think what we really need is a revamp of the financial system on how identities are established in the real world. It's not a technological problem. It's more of a process problem. I think that is the root cause. And I think how long is it going to take to for things to get better, I'm slightly pessimistic about that because I haven't seen, I've seen, I guess being in the security community, some talk about browser standards, so we've seen the EV certification and things like that. But I have yet to come across anything from the federal government or anything that recognizes this problem. And I've yet to see anything from academia that addresses the static identifier problem. And I think that's what we need to do to even get anywhere near to making things better.
Explain to me again, what is a static identifier?
It's just a fancy term for something that identifies who you are but never changes, right? So that is what I'm really talking about is your social security number.
Okay.
It identifies who you are. I mean, if I have your social security number and, for example, your date of birth, I have your identity, right? I mean, that is really what you're trying to protect.
Sure.
And I can commit financial transactions as if I were you. That's the problem. But once you give out your social security number, you're basically done for. I mean, there's nothing you can do. On the other hand, what we really need is a system where merely knowing your social security number should not compromise your identity. I mean, when we get to the point where if I could pull your credit report, right, and get all your credit card numbers and your social security number and your date of birth, and if we live in a system where even if I know that information, if I can't steal your identity, that's when we have made progress. And that's something that needs to come out of academia. Rather than putting technological band-aids on, UI standards and things like that, which may kind of soften the situation for a while.
And that does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.